This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. It has been 6 months since Israel's latest war on Palestinians began, and the death toll in Gaza has surpassed 33,000. Human Rights Watch has just released a report accusing Israel of using starvation, quote, as a weapon of war against Palestinians and particularly Gaza's children. Meanwhile, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres issued an urgent call to end Israel's war, saying it has unleashed, quote, relentless death and destruction to Palestinians in Gaza. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders has accused the Israel Defense Forces of targeting aid workers after the killings of 7 World Central Kitchen staff, saying the pattern of attacks is either intentional or indicative of reckless incompetence. In the meantime, activists and advocates of Palestinian rights are planning to set sail on a number of ships carrying aid directly to the people of Gaza as part of what they're calling a Freedom Flotilla Coalition. One of those who's going to be on that flotilla is my guest, Huwaida Araf. She's a frequent name here and someone familiar to our audience on this program. She's a Palestinian-American human and civil rights attorney, activist, and co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement, former chair of the Free Gaza Movement. Welcome back, Huwaida.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So first, before we talk about the Freedom Flotilla, let's talk about the six-month mark. You know, I was doing some research this morning ahead of our conversation, and nearly all of the media headlines of the six-month war were centered on Israel, how Israel is faring, how Israel is isolated, how Israeli family members of hostages are faring, or at best, there were attempts to equate the suffering of Gazans to those of Israelis. Is that, I suppose that's par for the course. It seems so out of touch, however, with how members of the American public are viewing what's happening 6 months into this war, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's really outrageous that the coverage continues to be, all about Israel and the survival of Israel and how popular or unpopular Israel is, when what we have is a plausible genocide taking place. And the only way that Palestinians are portrayed in mainly the Western mainstream media is sometimes as victims, but not of Israel, but of the circumstances, as we heard recently Secretary of State Anthony Blinken say, caught in the crossfire started by Hamas. It's really outrageous because the entire world sees what's happening. And since October 7th, people have also taken an interest in knowing more about why what is happening is happening, and are turning to sources that have been educating for a long time on the right of Palestinians to be free. And so education about Israel's long-standing settler colonial project and what Zionism has done, stripping people of a homeland, a right to enjoy basic freedoms, what Israel has done to Gaza specifically over the past 17 years, not only deny freedom, but put it under a brutal blockade that has devastated the Gaza Strip. And that's in addition to nearly 100 years of attempted erasure of the entire Palestinian people. That, to most people around the world, I think is becoming more clear. Some people are waking up to it new, but it's hard to ignore. Yet you still see the mainstream media outlets, and you still see our politician of Western countries putting it in the context of unfortunate victims of Israel's right to defend itself, which is, of course, an absurdity. This is about a settler colonial project that has been trying to erase the Palestinian people for nearly 100 years. And now it has escalated its genocidal attacks and attempt. And it is a shame that the first live stream genocide people and people's outrage and the movement of millions and millions of people around the world have not been able to stop it as Western powers continue to fuel and enable Israel. So it's really a sad and scary, if you ask me, state of our world today, which is what also motivates the action that we're about to take.
And the dehumanization of Palestinians in the media, unfortunately, remains. There's. It seems as though it doesn't matter how many Palestinians are killed; they are not humanized in the same way as either Israelis or Europeans and Americans. When we look at the tragic deaths and the killings of the World Central Kitchen employees, that got so much attention. You saw the faces of the people, you learned their names, you learned, who they were, and it seemed as though the killing of these seven people garnered so much more attention to them as individuals, as full, well-rounded human beings who, whose deaths caused pain, than the tens of thousands of Palestinians and more than 10,000 children who were killed, right? I mean, that disparity is so stark.
It is absolutely stark. And when you look at, if you want to attribute the outrage maybe to the fact that these were aid workers, let's say, well, Israel has killed nearly 200 other specifically aid workers in Gaza, most of them UN aid workers, and you didn't know their names. There's no kind of similar outrage because they were Palestinian aid workers. So it doesn't matter that they were aid workers, it doesn't matter that they worked for the United Nations. They were Palestinian and not international, and therefore you didn't know their names and faces and stories, and you didn't see the same kind of outrage, even though, like I said, nearly 200 other aid workers Israel has killed in the past 6 months. The dozens and dozens, over 100 journalists, again, they are all Palestinian journalists, and you don't know their names, you don't know their stories. And like you said, over 33,000, actually much higher, because we know there are still thousands of Palestinians, women, children, men buried under the rubble. So the death toll is actually going to turn out to be much higher when a full account can be taken. And that doesn't raise the same kind of ire or outrage. Those are kind of unfortunate, as I mentioned earlier, and it exposes the double standard, the hypocrisy that I think, the Western mainstream or Western countries are so used to, and they exude it with complete shamelessness. But more and more people, I mean, my hope is more and more people are becoming aware of this, and especially the younger generation. And we see a lot of activism and a lot of education on social media and other platforms calling this out. So I think that these, the outlets and the entities that continue to do this will find themselves more and more isolated, and history will not treat them well. That's my hope and what I hold on to.
Now, Human Rights Watch on Tuesday, April 9th, the day you and I are speaking, released a report, Israel's imposed starvation deadly for children. I mean, they use very strong words. This is a well-respected, international organization that does not take sides when it comes to, or doesn't as much take sides, certainly, when it comes to human rights violations. And even to Human Rights Watch, it's very clear that Israel is using starvation as a quote unquote weapon of war. And they actually call it a war crime, which is pretty incredible. They also cite South Africa's genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. Does this carry weight, where it matters most meaningfully to the US government that's fueling Israel's war with weapons?
Unfortunately, I don't think it. I think that the United States will try to downplay it. It will try to sweep it under the rug in order to continue its enabling and funding of Israel for political considerations. And we saw a couple of years ago when Human Rights Watch came out with its report labeling is what Israel is and what it's doing as apartheid, which is a crime against humanity. And the United States completely rejected that and continues to reject it. So the United States only accepts the reports of these human rights, respected human rights organizations like Human Rights Watch, as you said, like Amnesty International, when it serves, when it's in line with the United States' political objectives. Everything else, it downgrades. We heard just a couple of weeks ago, the United States actually slandering the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territory because she had submitted a report that found that the threshold for genocide has been met when it comes to Israel's conduct in Gaza. And the response of the United States was not to engage in her analysis or any of the facts she presented, but to label her as an anti-Semite and to say that the United States has long opposed this mandate and her position. Why would the United States, why would anyone oppose a position that is focused on assessing the situation of human rights anywhere? But that again is a pattern of the United States. But the report can be used in our other advocacy records, and I think it will be used also by the South African legal team, because not only is using starvation a weapon of war, not only that in itself is unlawful and it's a war crime, but it feeds into this the allegation that Israel is committing genocide. I mean, when you're trying to starve an entire people, you are trying to wipe them out, make it impossible for them to continue living. And so that would go also towards helping to prove the case of genocide in Gaza.
Now, this week, Israeli forces, there are reports saying that Israeli forces have withdrawn from Gaza, and particularly the southern part of Gaza. Some Palestinians have returned to find absolute hellish destruction, nothing left standing. What does this mean? Does this portend any kind of a ceasefire? Is it just a lull in fighting, as Israel continues to be shamed by the international community for its genocide?
Well, I think what we're seeing, like this massive senseless destruction of civilian homes, of hospitals, again, wiping out any kind of civilian infrastructure to make it very difficult, if not impossible, for Palestinians to go back to anything and then also to rebuild or to live on this land. So you hear Gazans saying, I mean, this is not even Gaza anymore, it's just a pile of rubble. And when you are engaged in genocidal acts, your attempt is to wipe out a portion or the entire a population of a group. And part of that in doing that is making it impossible for them to survive. So imposing on them conditions of life that will lead to their destruction. And when you are destroying all civilian infrastructure, and that is now before October 7th, Israel's tactics also were making life very, very difficult in Gaza. And a UN report had found that Gaza would be unlivable by 2020 due to the lack of potable water, which is a deliberate policy of Israel. So already before October 7th, Israel was making life very difficult, and it just escalated that to the nth degree and leaving all of Gaza in rubbles. I think all of this conduct and its senseless violence and destruction that could have no other purpose but to make it impossible for Palestinians to be able to continue life in this area. I think that will all go towards proving that Israel has been engaged in a genocide. But in the meantime, you look at the over a million civilians. I mean, you have over a million just right now in Rafah, waiting in imminent Israel land invasion. It's horrifying, and none of us can even begin to imagine what it's like to lose everything, and your every minute is at risk. You're at risk of being bombed to bits, you're at risk of starvation, you're at risk of disease, all of these things that are not being treated. And one of the most horrifying, if you can even say that anymore, because it has been one horror after the other, but it is very worrying, the report of the World Health Organization and other organizations saying that death from starvation and widespread disease will likely surpass the deaths that we have seen so far, over 33,000 from Israel's bombing and shelling. And even if Palestinians and Palestinian children survive this, the effects of being starved for such a long period of time, the malnutrition, that's not even counting the psychological impacts, the trauma. It is a generation, a society that is devastated, and it is overwhelming to try to think about even coming back from this while you are still actively under the bombs, and those of us who are actively campaigning to try to get a ceasefire to stop the bombs so Palestinians can survive and to somehow start to rebuild. It's all unspeakable, unbelievable.
Let's talk about what activists here in the United States, and I believe elsewhere as well in Europe, are planning to do to take direct action with regard to Gaza. Tell me about the Freedom Flotilla. Now, you and I have spoken over the years at numerous times when ships carrying aid have broken the siege of Gaza. There's a history here that is being the Freedom Flotilla is building on, and I understand later this month in April there will be yet another delivery, a direct delivery of aid. Tell our audience about this Freedom Flotilla.
Yes, thank you for this opportunity. As you said, later this month, we hope that a flotilla will set sail. It will be a number of ships carrying 5,500 tons of humanitarian aid and also hundreds of civilians from dozens of countries around the world. So we will have a cargo ship and we will have passenger vessels that will sail together towards Gaza, and we will be demanding access to Gaza. So Israel controls every entrance and exit to Gaza. It controls the waterways, it controls the airspace, it controls all the land crossing. And as we have said, it has had Gaza under a brutal blockade for 17 years. But its controls extends back to in 1967, but it just tightened the blockade in 2006, 2007, and started severely restricting what can get in and what can get out, devastating the economy and the lives of the people inside of the Palestinian people in Gaza. And that's when we started sailing boats to try to break this siege, to at least confront and challenge the policy, because it's an unlawful policy. It is a form of collective punishment. It has had a disproportionate, disastrous effect on civilian life, and yet nobody was making Israel change its policies or pressuring it or placing any kind of sanctions on Israel for this illegal policy. Collective punishment is also a war crime, and we've had a number of UN reports say that this blockade is unlawful. And so what we did in 2008 is sail two fishing boats from a European port through international waters straight into Gazan waters, not entering Israeli waters at all, to say that we want to get to the people of Gaza. They want to welcome us. They should have a right to do that. And if Israel says that its blockade is about security, here we are, a few dozen peace activists. We constitute no security threat. What is Israel going to do? And in 2008, Israel actually backed down from the confrontation with our boats at sea, and our boats became the first to reach Gaza port without permission from Israeli authorities in over 40 years. And not only did peace activists from around the world get in, and actually those first boats weren't carrying humanitarian aid, it was about confronting and challenging Israel's policy of placing the entire Palestinian civilian population of Gaza under this blockade. But we also were able to take out of Gaza people that Israel wasn't letting leave, whether for family reunification, for education. One young man that we took out was a 16-year-old boy who had his leg amputated from the hip due to an Israeli military operation in his neighborhood. He lost his leg, and then Israel was not giving him permission to go seek treatment elsewhere. So he was on our boat with his wheelchair and his father, and we sailed out of Israel with, I mean, of Gaza without seeking Israel's permission. And we sailed a few more times, successfully getting into Gaza. But at the end of 2008, Israel started hitting our boats. It almost capsized two boats, and it commandeered another one. And that's when we organized the large 2010 Gaza Freedom Flotilla. At that point, we were carrying 10,000 tons of aid because Israel had devastated Gaza in a military onslaught in 2008 and was not letting in building supplies, was not letting in, again, essentials that the Gazan people needed. And so we were carrying aid on that flotilla and 700 people from around the world. And Israel launched a military assault on us, which led to the death of 10 of our volunteers. The effort to continue to highlight Israel's brutal and unlawful blockade continued after that, but there has not been since then a flotilla of the size of the 2010 flotilla, and this one we hope will be. The situation, as we've talked about in Gaza, is not only untenable when we talk about civilian lives, but when we talk about the international legal order, the fact that we know Israeli leaders have declared pretty shamelessly that they are starving the Palestinian people, that they intend to and they will cut Palestinians off from food, water, and other life necessities. And after the International Court of Justice found a plausible case of genocide in Gaza, the fact that Israel remains in control of what humanitarian aid can reach the people is outrageous. It should not be that the very entity that declared its intention to starve the Palestinian people is allowed to control what aid can reach the people. And yet, that's the way it is. When we talk about trucks getting in, even through Egypt, that's controlled by Israel. When we talk about the pier, the floating pier that the United States is building, and the maritime route that's open with Cyprus, where the World Central Kitchen was bringing in some food, that's also controlled by Cyprus in coordination. And Israel, sorry, it's controlled by Israel. Israel checks everything that comes in. When we talk about the airdrops that the United States and Jordan have been involved in, the rather deadly drops of food is also coordinated through Israel. So whatever Israel doesn't allow doesn't get in. And that's why we see that the international organizations have been raising the alarm, not only about the deadly airstrikes, but the fact that people are starving and famine is setting in certainly in the north of Gaza, and that will spread. Everybody in Gaza is malnutrition. That's because the world allows Israel to continue to control this. And then the list of supplies that Israel does not allow in is long. It's constantly changing at Israel's whim, and it includes things like anesthesia. So you have doctors performing amputations on children without anesthesia because Israel will not allow in anesthesia. Like, that is inhumane and barbaric. And so we intend to carry on our ships these kinds of life-saving aids and medicines that Israel has not allowed in. We are not going to agree to any kind of checks by Israel, though we will have lots of media on board that can check our cargo. We will be checked by the port authorities, and we are inviting humanitarian aid organizations to also check our cargo. But what we are not doing is subjecting ourselves to Israel's kind of restrictions and dictates about what is allowed in and what is not allowed in. This is life-saving aid that the people of Gaza need. We intend to deliver it, but more than that, we're also going with a strong political message that the Palestinian people not only need this aid, but they don't want to live on aid, and the world has to address the situation that has left Palestinians in need of aid, and that is restraining Israel, that is ending the blockade and ending Israel's occupation and colonization of Palestinian land. Palestinians need, want, and deserve to be free. And it starts with, not leaving Israel or letting Israel be in control of what aid can get to Palestinians. But beyond that, Palestinians need liberation. And so We intend within a couple of weeks' time to set sail. As you said, we will have lots of media on board and ensure that we have communication capabilities on our ships to be able to live stream as much as possible and report from the sea. We hope that Israel does not attack our vessels, and we will be calling on all our supporters and on our government to demand that Israel not only not attack our ships, but that guarantees us safe passage to Gaza so that we can deliver, unload the aid, and start breaking this control, this Israel siege.
Is there a way for people to be able to donate to purchase the aid? You said there's maybe 5,500 tons of humanitarian aid. I imagine, that costs a lot of money, the cost of the ships itself. A lot of people, Americans especially, have been feeling desperately helpless as they've watched the genocide unfold. And short of, trying to move this immovable government to stop funding Israel's genocide, how can they help the Freedom Flotilla and feel like they're doing something to help the people of Gaza?
Yes, thank you for that. We can use all of the financial support that we can get. And the Freedom Flotilla Coalition that is planning this is made up of groups in a dozen different countries. And in the US, we have an affiliate. It's called US Boats to Gaza. So if someone goes to our website, they will see more information about the Freedom Flotilla and how to donate. It's just US Boats, plural, boats. To togaza.org. And then they'll be able to also follow the flotilla because while we definitely need monetary support, we also need all eyes on the flotilla. That will be our biggest protection. We will be putting out also alerts to ask people to take action, like calling the White House and demanding safe passage for the flotilla. So please do go to usboatstogaza.org to donate and to follow. And then the International Coalition's website is freedomflotilla.org. All contributions made via the US Boats to Gaza site are tax deductible through our fiscal sponsor. So usboatstogaza.org and freedomflotilla.org to follow us.
And finally, do you know of Palestinians expecting the aid? I know in the past when the Freedom Flotilla has broken the siege, it was a great sense of relief and feeling that there was solidarity on the part of Palestinians, even if at that time it was symbolic. This time it's actually bringing, and previous times also it has actually brought concrete aid. Do you know if Palestinians are awaiting this?
We have talked to some partners on the ground, and they are certainly hopeful. But the majority of Palestinians in Gaza are cut off from communications. People have not even been able to communicate with their loved ones around the country, around the world, sorry. And therefore, I don't think it's not a situation like we had, in 2008 when we got through, when everyone was watching the news to see what would happen to our boats. And you're right, when we actually got in 2008, tens of thousands of people rushed to the port to welcome us. It was really something else. But today, people are just trying to survive and are largely cut off from communication. So I don't think so.
Well, we'll certainly be keeping our eye on the Freedom Flotilla's latest chapter as it heads toward Gaza. Huwaida, thank you so much for all you do and for joining us today. Good luck.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Huwaida Araf, Palestinian American human and civil rights attorney, activist and co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement, former chair of the Free Gaza Movement, and one of the organizers of the Freedom Flotilla to Gaza. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.